the monologue.
So apparently you don't have to pay rent anymore in the city of Seattle. The new mayor, Bruce Harrell, announcing the eviction moratorium that started in March of 2020 will be extended another 30 days. An announcement that comes 30 days before another announcement that says the exact same thing. And we'll do that over and over and over again some more.
We will continue to allow flexibility, and no shutoffs policy from Seattle Public Utilities and Seattle City Light. We can't have people without power and water.
No, I got that. We can't have people without power or water. And we can't have people without a place to live, except, of course, the landlord that owns the property that now is in jeopardy even worse than it was before, because you don't want people to get jobs, apparently. We have millions, record high, millions and millions and millions and millions of open jobs in this country. Something tells me we have our fair share of open jobs here in Seattle. In fact, I know we do. And you are saying people don't need to pay their rent. Explain why. Why don't they have jobs? Oh, they do have jobs? Okay, well then why aren't they paying? Oh, well, things are tight right now. They don't have the same hours as they used to. Really? They don't have the same hours that they used to? We're fully open. We are fully open in Seattle. We are fully open in King County. So what exactly is the issue here? We're trying to prevent homelessness. Really? Well, first of all, you've never been trying to prevent homelessness in the city of Seattle. That's why it's gotten so much worse than it was. But can you point to anyone? Seriously, can you point to anyone who got evicted because they couldn't afford the rent for 1 month? I'm curious who that person is. You talk about that person, but it feels like it's becoming a myth. Will Toastburn, with solid ground, he loves this idea.
The city of Seattle eviction moratorium is working well and doing what it's supposed to do, which is protect renters in this very dangerous time from losing their housing.
Who's protecting the person who owns the property? Oh, yes, I forgot. In Seattle, we pretend that if you're a landlord, you, because you own property, it means you're wealthy and privileged. You can afford to not go with rent for 2 years. You can go without rent since March of 2020. It's doing what it's supposed to. And he's actually right. It is doing what it's supposed to. Protecting people who don't pay their rent from getting evicted. It's not supposed to protect the landlord. It was never supposed to protect the landlord. They would sometimes say that, throw it out there just pretending, because they know someone like me might call this out. We have millions of open jobs for anyone who needs one. We have a fully reopened economy. They can pay the rent. And if they still can't pay the rent after all of this time, might be something else going on. Exactly. They know there might be something else going on. And they are hoping to extend this over and over and over again some more, because they eventually want to forgive all of the money that is owed. So these people end up getting free housing, which has been the progressive goal this entire time. Pre-COVID. They say it all the time. We're not going to sweep these encampments until we have a home for them to go. Subsidized housing. Housing projects that they create and manage. Because you know what? Especially when it comes to housing projects, they do such an amazing job.
The interview.
Seattle Police Foundation does some really amazing work, and they step up when officers need the support the most. They have done lots of fundraisers for different organizations within the agency. They help raise funds for equipment needs. And now they're stepping up in the aftermath of the killing of K-9 police officer Jedi. Jedi, of course, was stabbed to death by an armed burglar who was trying to break into a home with both a knife and a machete. The K-9 unit was activated to help subdue the suspect. Jedi did the work he was trained to do, but ultimately paid the ultimate price. Joining me on the line is the president of the Seattle Police Foundation, Sherry Skager. Sherry, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me on today, Jason.
Take us through how the organization is now stepping up, Seattle Police Foundation, to help.
Sure, sure. Well, first of all, I just want to say that this one hits us really hard. Jedi was, you know, by all accounts, a great police dog and a wonderful ambassador mm-hmm. to the department. And, you know, I do want to say that his death is an example of the dangerous and often, you know, very unpredictable situations that officers are a part of every day. So last week after his death, we received just an outpouring of inquiries from the community who wanted to do something, you know, to honor the sacrifice that Jedi had made for our community. And so with the permission of the K-9 unit, we have created a donation link for those who wish to contribute to honor Jedi's memory. And the funds will be used to do some sort of memorial for Jedi, for the department, and then also the remainder will go to support the K-9 unit, who you can imagine is you know, really hurting right now, and will go towards purchasing future dogs, additional training for handlers and the dogs, as well as K-9 safety equipment.
And, you know, the amount of money that's spent in this unit is pretty extensive when you think about it, right? I mean, it's not just about finding the right dogs, and you don't always know which dog is going to commit to the program, be right for the program, but it's lots of training.
Absolutely. And it's like daily training. These the handlers and the canines work hours and hours every day to make sure that they are doing their jobs well and doing their jobs safely and are able to, you know, show up when you know, the community needs them the most. And also there's equipment that the K-9 handlers and the dogs need to keep them safe. And so the foundation's very, very invested in making sure they have everything that they need.
And folks can donate directly at seattlepolicefoundation.org. It's seattlepolicefoundation.org. Or, of course, you can text the keyword RANTZ, R-A-N-T-Z, to 1-800-465-8770. I'll send you a direct link so you can donate. And all the money that goes into this particular fund actually makes it to the K-9 unit and does not necessarily get distributed elsewhere within the police department, correct?
Correct. 100% goes to the K-9 unit. And I also wanted to mention, Jason, that the South Precinct, which is where Jedi mm-hmm. operated out of for the majority of the time, has a public memorial in their lobby that goes through 6 p.m. today. So people want to stop by, leave flowers, leave a card, et cetera. You're welcome to do that. And we're working to try to get that extended till the end of the week. And I can give you that information once that's been confirmed.
Oh, absolutely. We would love to do that. And again, seattlepolicefoundation.org. Go there now. Make sure you donate to a worthy cause. This is a department that's reeling as a result of it. And just very, very quickly, because we've got about 30 seconds left, how is the department overall responding? Obviously, you guys have a lot of contact with officers.
Sure. Well, again, this is a hard hit for everyone at SPD, and you know, we want to make sure that we're letting them know that the community has their back and is supporting them through this very hard time.
Yeah. Again, seattlepolicefoundation.org, seattlepolicefoundation.org, or you can text the keyword RANTZ, R-A-N-T-Z, to 1-800-465-8770. And we'll send you a direct link. I wish you guys didn't have to do this kind of work, but I'm glad that you're there to do it when the call comes that you need to step up and help. So thank you so much for the work that you're doing with the Seattle Police Foundation. I've heard from a lot of officers who are very thankful for everything that you guys do. We've been talking with the president of SPF, Sherry Skager. Sherry, thank you so much again. Really appreciate it.
Thanks, Jason.
And again, folks, seattlepolicefoundation.org. I want to make sure that every single person who's listening right now, whether it's on the radio right now or via podcast, I want to make sure you're going to seattlepolicefoundation.org. Give what you can. If it's $10, it's $10 to a great cause. If it's $100, even better. seattlepolicefoundation.org.
The interview.
As we told you yesterday, arguably spending a little bit too much time on it, on January 22nd, it is Local Quilt Shop Day, where you are supposed to go to your local quilt shops, engage in some good old-fashioned shopping, but also learn more about the culture behind quilting. It's something I did not know really existed. Joining me on the line, as we promised we would do, the coordinator of Local Quilt Shop Day, Deb Messina. Deb, welcome to the show.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
So, I don't know anything whatsoever about quilting. I know what a quilt is, and I certainly understand the concept of going out and shopping at quilt shops, but just big picture, just the 30-second pitch, what is this event?
This event, Local Quilt Shop Day, was created in 2011 by the Fabric Shop Network, which is a trade organization representing independent, family-owned quilt shops worldwide. And the event is scheduled generally for the fourth Saturday in January each year. And it's really a celebration of the art and the history and the traditions of quilting. And since you probably don't spend a lot of time in quilt shops, I can tell you as a quilter that quilt shops are not only a place to get your supplies for creating a quilt, but it's also a place for community. It's a place for passing on traditions. It's a place for learning new things and sharing what you've created. And during the pandemic, most quilt shops didn't close. They were open because they were considered essential because they supplied fabrics and materials to make masks.
Interesting.
So, yeah, and they provide a pretty big economic impact to local communities everywhere as well.
So when I talked about this yesterday on the show, we got some text messages from a bunch of folks telling us, what are you talking about? There's tons of quilt shops, because we were saying to ourselves, how many could there possibly be? How large is this community in Washington State? I mean, are we at the point where there's enough quilters or quilt enthusiasts to create like a dating app just for quilting?
Oh, that already exists.
Of course it does.
Of course. I can tell you that in the state of Washington, right now there are 166 quilt shops.
Jeez. Okay, so that is a lot.
It is a lot. There's one or more quilt shops in nearly every community across the state of Washington.
What city maybe or cities in Washington are considered like the hot spots for quilting?
Oh my gosh.
That many?
Oh yeah, it's everywhere. If you live in Washington, you're not more, in generally speaking, than a 20-minute drive from multiple quilt shops.
So who is the perfect person for this community, or who represent what kind? If you were to give me the demographic makeup of someone who's already in this community and representative of the community, how would you describe them?
Well, I would say traditionally it's primarily, but not exclusively, women above the age of, say, 45, because children are grown at that point and you have a little bit more disposable income generally, and you're starting to maybe see grandchildren. And that's oftentimes someone's first foray into making a quilt. Is, you know, my child's going to have a child and I want to welcome them to the world with a quilt that I made. And I know I was a shop owner for many years, and I welcomed lots of, you know, soon to be new grandmas into my shop, and a few grandpas, and we got them started, and they're still quilting.
So if it's
once you start to get addicted.
No, I hear you. If it's primarily older women, you know, we live in a different time now. It's 2022. What are you guys doing in the community for, you know, diversity, equity, and inclusion? Are there any, anti-racist efforts going on to widen the diversity of the community?
Oh, quilting is probably one of the most inclusive art forms or crafts. There are Facebook groups all over that platform that welcome anybody who, you just have to have an interest in learning, and there will be a community to teach you.
So last question then for you, because we're running low on time, and I'm actually kind of, I know functionally they serve the same purpose, but what's the difference between a quilt and a blanket?
A blanket is a single layer, generally woven. A quilt is a layered construction of a top, a batting layer, and a bottom. And then it's stitched, which is actually the quilting part.
Mm-hmm.
When you make the top, generally it's pieced from lots of different small pieces of fabric, or appliqued with fabrics layered on top and stitched down. And then you take those three layers and you stitch them together, creating a single layer, and then bind the edge, and that's much better than a blanket.
Okay, so it'll keep me more warm, or warmer.
Well, it will warm your heart as well as your body.
What if you are a talk radio host who doesn't necessarily like to show the heart? One who has seen too much stuff in the news that has turned him into an angry person. You're telling me that this product can change someone's life.
So let me tell you that I've met lots of people coming from lots of industries,
mm-hmm,
who struggle with stress and with PTSD, mm-hmm, and with a variety of other things. Quilting is very calming. It's emotionally satisfying to do as an activity. And you end up with a beautiful art object that is also functional. It can be a gift. You can keep it to yourself. You can make it small, teeny tiny. You can make it huge.
But I'll be honest, Deb. I don't want to do that because I don't need to put another thing out there as to why I'm single. But I will. I'll buy one. Is that okay, or do I have to sew it myself, or can I just buy one?
Well, many quilt shops have samples made up that they are no longer using to promote the products in their shop, and they do sell their samples.
Huh.
So, yeah, it is possible.
Okay. I'll go on the market for a pre-made quilt. I'm just not going to do it myself. Let me get to that point in my life where I've completely given up on finding someone else and then commit that hardcore to a hobby. With all due respect, we've been talking with Deb Messina. She's the coordinator of Local Quilt Shop Day. It is on Saturday, January 22nd. So make sure on that day you go out and you just go all in and get all the materials you can for quilting, help the economy, and make me a quilt. Because again, like I said, I'm not going to make one myself. Deb, thank you so much for stopping by. I am just fascinated by this, and I appreciate your time.
Thank you so much. I enjoyed it.
Absolutely. You're listening to The Jason Rand Show.
The Jason Rand Show.
Jason Rantz, Seattle radio host, joins us now.
Jason, you're the perfect guest on this.
Jason Rantz, welcome back, Jason.
I see you often on other programs here.
Jason, what's going on?
Jason, thanks for coming on.
The Quick Hit.
Okay, so we've got some serious issues going on with the anti-policing bills, although I know that Democrats call them reimagining policing. It's not really about reimagining policing. It's been about dismantling policing, and they very clearly went too far, so far that they're even admitting that they have to make some changes. Whether or not they actually make the changes, no idea. What those changes will functionally look like, don't know. Joining me on the line to explain the situation from the law enforcement perspective, Snohomish County Sheriff Adam Fortney. Welcome back to the show.
Thank you, sir. It is great to talk to you again.
So, obviously, policing in the state of Washington changed dramatically last year thanks to the series of bills. Take us through, just first, big picture, how it's impacted law enforcement.
Oh, gosh, that's tough to do in a short amount of time, but I'll try. So, yeah, 2021 changed the way law enforcement does business in the entire state of Washington. So, they passed the bills early in the legislative session early in the year. Governor signs them, I think it was the end of March, April-ish, somewhere in there. And then we had about 60 days, give or take a couple of days, to both read the laws, interpret them, figure out policy, and then train our people. That is a monumental task in the world of government and public safety in 2021. But we did it. It wasn't exactly clear. We didn't have all the answers for our folks, but we did it. And then so we have these new laws, and, you know, they changed use of force language. They changed pursuit policy. They changed, you know, a lot. I guess I'd put it this way. We could still respond to calls, and the Snohomish County Sheriff's Office took that approach. We took a respond and assess approach. We didn't throw our hands in the air and just say we're not going anything anymore. But what changed is what we could do when we got there. And I know you've seen and you've covered it, and I've been pretty vocal on my social media about some of the impacts to public safety that we've seen, and they're out there. I'm right now, it's the first week of the session in 2022, Jason. I'm going to be optimistic. There's bills floating around like crazy. And, you know, what you said in your opening, too, is the legislators down there, they have agreed that they're going to fix some of this stuff. So what they come up with, no one knows yet, but I'm going to be optimistic for now.
Yeah, the question becomes, will the fix actually be a fix, or will it be a Band-Aid? Will it be just makeup? And the truth of the matter is the problem still exists. Take me through, if you could, just one example, one story from the last year that comes to mind when you say this could have ended a different way had we not had one of these bills passed by the Democrats, or at least passed in the way that it was done.
Yeah, absolutely. And so I know the exact one I want to go to right away. And this is, comes in the area of people in the mental health crisis, or we call it behavior health contact now. And the police deal with it all the time. I know there's some activists that want us out of that business completely. I'm actually not opposed to that, but I don't think there's a pathway yet. And what they did is they changed the threshold for the police to be able to use force to where the main thing is there has to be probable cause for someone's arrest. When we are dealing with people in a mental health crisis, they are not under arrest. But prior to this legislation, we were allowed to use a reasonable amount of force, you know, to get that person help if they needed. And what happened in post July 25th for us and in our South County, our busiest precinct, is we had both medics and law enforcement deputies dispatched to a family that called in their adult son in a mental health crisis. So we respond. He had already left the house. The medics found him a couple blocks away, basically laying down in the bed of a pickup truck, just laying there. So we're doing all the right things. We're talking to him. You know, we're keeping distance. We and the medics determined that he needs help this day and he's going to have to go. But this is the crux of the issue. Unless that person in crisis is willing to walk on his own accord into the back of the aid unit and go to the hospital to get the help, we cannot use force because of this new legislation. And what happened, and I'll wrap it up real quickly, he ends up taking off and there's literally nothing that we could do about it. We watched him run away. He jumps fences. He enters someone else's home unlawfully after he shed his clothing. And that homeowner had to hold that person in crisis again at knife point until we were redispatched and had to go deal with now the new issue that came up. So that is that's a glaring example of the impact to not just the person in crisis, not just the person in crisis family, but the community as well with this new legislation.
Adam Fortney is the sheriff of Snohomish County. He's on the line to talk about some of the much-needed reforms to the reforms that were passed last year in the height of the BLM movement, the anti-police movement that a lot of Democrats took advantage of, in my view, to try to dismantle systems of oppression. And, you know, one of the other issues that you were involved in early on was the banning of, you know, certain weapons of a certain caliber size. And, you know, it ended up banning non-lethal weapons like beanbag guns, like the soft tip foam bullets that don't actually kill anyone. You were one of the agencies that said, yeah, we're going to follow the letter of the law because we have no clue whether or not, it doesn't matter whether or not it's your intent was to ban non-lethal weapons. It's what the law says. And your officers, your deputies, could be put in hot water if something goes wrong.
Yeah, absolutely. We pulled ours from the street. We had to. I don't think we had an option. You know, I'm also responsible for our employees and trying to take care of them as well. And whether they meant to or not, I don't think they meant to. I'll take them at their word for that. That is the letter of the law. And I can't have my deputies out there using a weapon that has now been banned by the state legislature. So, yeah, that absolutely impacted us. And, you know, it takes a full year to overcome that, where at the end of this month, into early next month, we'll have some more less lethal. But, you know, it's taken a long time to get there.
Yeah, and it's ridiculous because one of the lawmakers who pushed for this was State Representative Roger Goodman, and he gave an interview, I believe it was to the local NPR affiliate, saying, you know, that wasn't our intent. You can continue to use it, and we'll fix it in the new year. But that's a judge does not look at an interview that one lawmaker gives as a thumbs up, because another lawmaker could say the opposite of what that lawmaker said. Someone could say, hey, never mind. Don't go ahead and do the Long-Term Care Trust Act because we never intended it to happen. Yeah, that's not how the law works. A judge who looks at the law looks at the law. You say go ahead. Sorry.
No, think of it this way. So the state legislature passes the most sweeping police reform packages, if you will, in the country, I would say. But then they go ahead and say, we didn't really mean this. You can go ahead and use it. But they have all these triggers in place, you know, to hold the police accountable. Goodness gracious, no, we're not going to put our own people in that position. There's no way we could do that.
Yeah, and some of the agencies that decided that they were going to continue with the weaponry, officers just weren't carrying it with them. Seattle Police Department is a good example of that. You can good luck finding an officer who's still carrying anything having to do with the non-lethal weapons because they don't think that they're going to be protected should this come up. You say you think everything's going to go well, or at least you're hopeful that things will go well. But the truth of the matter is, you know, that could still take a while. How confident are you that the issues that continue to persist will be able to hold off in the interim? Is it just, well, we've already done it this long, we'll just go a few more weeks?
It's impossible to say in the world of public safety. It's unpredictable. I mean, we could have another call like the example I gave, you know, 30 minutes from now or 3 days from now. It's just completely unpredictable. That's why I was really pushing for a special session. I thought it warranted mm-hmm. it because of the timing, but clearly that didn't happen in there in session now. And one of the other things I've done, because and like I said, I've been pretty vocal about my not supporting these changes and things like that. But I do got to say, I've spent the last 2 months meeting with every legislature in Snohomish County, minus about three just because of scheduling. The talks have gone well, and I don't want to be all negative. I want to be positive sure. as well. The conversations were good. I think they do get it. But now we're going to see if they can put their money where their mouth is with this new session and make some of these changes. I think they will, Jason. I think the behavioral health thing and the use of force, I think that's going to get fixed.
Hope so.
There's also the issue with police pursuits, which doesn't get the attention that nope. some others does, and I understand why, but it's a real issue. I don't know if that one's going to get fixed or not, but we're going to keep pushing for it.
Yeah, and remember, folks, if they don't fix that one, for the most part, criminals will very easily be able to just drive away. They have raised the bar from reasonable suspicion, and now it's almost impossible to go ahead and make that pursuit. And by the way, even if they met all of the factors to pursue, they still would have to get permission from someone higher above them before they would be able to do it. It is such a disaster. Before we let you go, we only have about a minute left. I'll give you a chance to respond to that, but also if you could, take us through just sort of the staffing crisis, if one exists right now within your department, as it relates to Omicron and the spread. We've seen in Seattle, for example, SPD is getting hit pretty hard by the spread of COVID, despite in their case having a fully vaccinated force. What's going on in Snohomish County?
Yeah, and I'm going to follow up one thing on police pursuits, and that is that when you tell the criminal element ahead of time that you can't chase you unless it's the most violent of felonies, what do you think is going to happen? They know the rules, too. Yep. And every single day, they're just taking off from people. I hope that gets fixed. We'll see. Okay, Omicron and COVID. Yeah, we're seeing it to a certain extent. I mean, the stuff is just everywhere right now. Jesus, it is everywhere. We haven't had any major cases, which I'm thankful for. But yeah, it's impacted. I wouldn't say we're in crisis mode. We absolutely have plans in place, both in corrections and the law enforcement side of the house, if we do reach that point. But so far, so good up here. We do have some employees that are out sick, but we're just not in crisis mode yet. So I'm very thankful for that.
Are you thinking about running for re-election?
That's a year away, Jason.
I know, but you got to start thinking about that now.
The talk is already here. I wish I wasn't talking about it 2 years out, but it is absolutely here. I've been asked a lot. I mean, you asked me, so I'll give you an answer. I'm absolutely running in 2023, man. I am so proud of what we have going on here at the Sheriff's Office. It's been a bumpy road, but it has for all of law enforcement in the last couple of years with everything we've gone through. But yeah, I'll be in 2023. You're not going to see any campaigning or anything like that until about a year from now. But yeah, unless something drastic changes between now and then, I am super excited about what the Snohomish County Sheriff's Office has going on.
Love it. You've done some really, really amazing work in difficult circumstances in Snohomish County. You've fended off some of the lunatic activists in the community. So kudos to you for that, because a lot of people could have just given up. You definitely have not. Adam Fortney, Sheriff of Snohomish County. Thank you so much, my friend, for coming on. I really appreciate it.
You got it, sir. Have a great day.
You as well.
The Jason Rance Show.
Let's bring in our man in the Pacific Northwest, KTTH, Seattle talk radio host Jason Rance. Great to have you with us to tell people a little bit more about this.
Jason Rance is in focus now.
Jason Rance, thank you for your reporting on that.
The quick hit.
Okay, so it's very difficult right now to get a COVID test, whether you're going into a store to purchase a, you know, antigen test, or maybe going on Amazon to get one of the PCR test packages. It's very difficult for you to do that. At the same time, it's difficult for you to actually get an appointment to get a test. There's something going on with Curative, for example, in Seattle. Don't know exactly what it is yet, because I'm still trying to find the point person even, which is also kind of odd to me. But, you know, we have a situation where going to get a test, there's usually a line. And that was before the rush on tests, and there were plenty of staff members there. But all of a sudden, at least at one of the locations, no line. I'm told it was all, though, filled, all the spots filled, no line, and considerably fewer staff than before. So my suspicion is either they're running out of tests or something else is brewing that we don't know about. But that right now is a suspicion. What we can tell you, though, obviously, is that it's hard to get a test. Regardless of the reasons, regardless of where we are, it's difficult to get a test. And so I saw this story out of Como News that, you know, quotes these experts about how the real case number of COVID is much higher than we think. And they say brand new numbers from the State Department of Health show nearly 14,000 new cases in the last day, continuing the trend since Christmas. But doctors said the infection rate could actually be much higher than the numbers indicate, because the stats don't include unreported positive cases. And they quote Ali Mokhtad from the Institute for Health Metrics and Evaluation Chief Strategy, or Evaluation, that's at UW, he's the Chief Strategy Officer. He says, many cases are out there undetected. People could be going to their office right now and they could be infectious. So this is not new. And this is not unique to running low on tests. I suppose it makes it more likely than before, if you were someone who was constantly getting tested, to now possibly have COVID and infect people because you can't get, I guess that's more likely. But the truth is, we know right now that the case rate for COVID is way higher than what we're being told. Because of the asymptomatic spread, people who didn't get tested still have never even seen a test, already had COVID. They didn't even realize it. Or they did realize it, or they suspected it, and that was that. They got over it really quickly, and then they moved on. Whether we're talking about Omicron, Delta, or the original strain, we know that as a matter of fact. And again, I'm knocking on wood, mostly because I don't want to get COVID. I'm not looking to get COVID. I'm not going around licking doorknobs or anything, but I'm suspicious of my own health in that I wonder if I've already had COVID and didn't realize it, because I still haven't gotten it, despite the ton of travel that I'm doing, tons. And I'm only going to hotspots, apparently, or conservative run areas. So, you know, none of this is new. Kids in particular, especially at the start, they had COVID. No one knew, because they were asymptomatic. It's part of the reason why we say on the show, whenever we talk about the death rate, we say it's about 1% according to the stats, but we know that that's most likely wrong. It's much lower than that, because we can't, when we come up with those stats, we can't account for the number of people who truly had COVID. And so when we say 1%, it's probably something like 0.2%, 0.3%, something remarkably low. So I don't know what the point of this is. And it should have been reported a while ago. And on top of that, it should have been discussed in a positive way. It should be discussed in a positive way. The fact that we have way more people who had COVID that we don't know about
meaning they didn't suffer any consequences as a result, because if they did, we would then know about it. These are people who did not go to the hospital. These are people who did not die. Otherwise, we would have been able to track that. These are people who were fine. That's good news. That means we're much closer to herd immunity and probably have already exceeded it than people want to admit. And there are a lot of people out there who don't want to admit it because they want to keep us in this. Whether they're doing it knowingly or not doesn't matter. But they want to keep us in this perpetual state of fear of COVID. They like the power that's come with it, or they like the feelings they have, believing that they're heroes protecting us from COVID, protecting us from inevitable death. That's not actually inevitable for the vast majority of people. Doesn't mean you can't die. Doesn't mean you can't get seriously sick. Obviously, that's the case. It's true that you can both. But there are people who want to overstate the threat, and thus they downplay stories like this. And so kudos, I guess, for Como News to report it. It's just really, really late to the game, in my view. It feels like they could have done this a long time ago.
The Last Rants.
And finally, as we reflect still on the controversy in the Mukilteo School District with To Kill a Mockingbird, where a bunch of mostly white people, though not exclusively white people, want to ban the book from the required reading list for the school, and they were making the argument about how it's offensive. So offensive. And at the school board meeting that I watched the entirety of, at least on this topic, there was at least one school board member who acknowledged, I haven't read this book in a long time. And it got me thinking about one particular issue of not just judging a book and unfairly judging a book by contemporary standards and not taking into consideration any context of how a book is taught or discussed or, you know, analyzed. It did get me thinking about people who just simply take a position that this book or this movie or this whatever is offensive on its face, and they won't even dive into it. Because as I said, books are going to constantly go through analysis, and I have no problem taking books off required school lists, reading lists, if you do it for the right reasons. This obviously is not the right reason. But there are some people out there who take a position of, I would never read something like that because it's crazy. And yet they still talk about it. And a good example is How to Be an Anti-Racist, the Ibram Kendi book. Ibram called me out on Twitter the other day claiming that I never read his book, and yet it doesn't stop me from talking about him. No, I read your book. I read How to Be Anti-Racist, or How Not to Be, or whatever it's called. It's literally on my desk. It's in my desk. I haven't taken it out in a while. I read the book. I'm not scared of reading even stupid things that I disagree with, that I think there's value in reading, just so you can better understand the context of conversations or have better conversations. Folks on the left don't want to do that ever. They will never read a Ben Shapiro book. They'll never read a Mark Levin book or Michael Knowles book or soon Jason Rand's book. So I want to make sure that you guys aren't falling into that trap. The same way it's very easy for us to do what they're doing, which is just say no to content just on the surface. You don't have to read anything, and you don't have to read something to talk about it, but I would just say have an open mind to reading some of these materials or watching some of them if they are, in fact, part of the sort of the zeitgeist, the cultural zeitgeist, so that you're better informed, so you can push back much easier. And that's The Last Rants.